activities can also be useful for letting out the additional energy of the child. It is partly, of course, about the theory of, you know, extra energy, extra power to let it out.
Mm-hmm.
If the additional energy is not used in a correct way and it is stored unsatisfied in the child's body, it makes him uneasy. It makes him nervous. It makes him bad-tempered. Okay. So it's good to let out the energy. That's one aspect only. Okay. We're looking at it holistically. That why Islam encourages so much to play.
All
so
right.
It's the physical aspect. Then it's the psychological importance in a way. Playing gives a child a chance to express his feelings. It's very important for a child to express. You know, his vocabulary is limited.
Mm-hmm.
So he needs to express his feelings, you know, how he feels about certain things.
Okay.
So he can bring out his pressed energy by means of play.
Right.
A child can express his feelings through fear, through annoyance, through anxiety, through happiness. So in the frame of his desired personalities, however he likes it, mm-hmm. he can do also, let out his negative energy, and also he can let out his positive energy. Both through playing. So that's the psychological importance.
So what do you mean by negative energy?
Negative energy as in, for example, he feels bored. So you'll see him breaking his toys, you know. That's expressing this feeling. And one should not be disturbed at this. You know, parents, they
so
should...
So it is okay?
It's completely normal.
Okay.
He's expressing his feelings,
mm-hmm.
which is a good way. You know, expressing your feelings in terms of this way is better than expressing your feelings in terms of voice and language.
Mm-hmm.
So it's okay for a child to do that, of course.
Okay.
For adults, if they continue, then they'll be breaking things in the house.
True, yes.
But for children, it's completely normal that you should let them let out their tension.
All right.
So you can know, a parent who is alert can know that the child is bored
mm-hmm.
now. So it's such a good way, right?
Okay.
To let them play.
So before you move on, I was a bit confused, like when you talked about the theories first and then you come to the Islamic aspect. So basically the theories you talked about is talked in Islam as well. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, but in a different way.
In a different way.
If you go and see.
Right.
That suffices only, this prolongs it and makes it more rational.
Okay.
Right?
All right.
And it looks at it holistically.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So, and then there's the upbringing importance. The importance of upbringing in a child through play is by playing that the true personality of the child takes its shape.
Okay.
And the considerable changes that happen in the spirit, all of it which are a passage to the higher stage of growth happens. Playing will provide a kind of development for the children. And it is here that the opportunities and facilities in bringing up are made so clear and made so certain.
Okay, so basically if parents play with their kids, they can actually bring them up much better. Like, you know, through playing, you can explain them stuff rather than...
Exposing their potentials.
Okay, rather than explaining to them directly.
Example, if you can see, if you just give building blocks to a child, they can build amazing things, yeah?
All right.
So you can know a child has this. Then there's the social importance. It's very important. In playing, a child learns how to socially communicate with others who are outside his family unit and learns how to solve the problems and difficulties that emerge from these kind of communications.
Okay.
And he also learns how to socially adapt to others. Because, you know, in the family, you see everybody is like on the side of the child.
So, Sister Salma Khalfan, let's just take a break and we'll be back. Dear listeners, stay tuned and don't go away. We'll be back soon.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said The child's playfulness in his childhood causes the increase of his intellect in his adulthood
يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. So, Sister Khalfan, we were talking about the social importance. You want to enlighten more on that?
Yeah, I just want to say to the audience that sometimes, you know, socially, the child learns how to adapt with the other people, the community members, the friends, the other families. Because within his families, maybe considered to be understood more,
okay.
Or he knows how to, you know, like play with them, like the parents, the cousins, you know, whoever they are,
okay.
The siblings.
Mm-hmm.
But outside, he doesn't know what kind of characteristics the children have. Yeah,
all right.
They might be probably very quiet, very rowdy.
Mm-hmm.
So this child learns how to adapt, which we need that in Islam for him to socially adapt to his community.
All right.
And then there is the educational importance. Through playing, we can learn a lot, isn't
okay,
it?
Yes, true.
We can, in fact, they say that better not teach formally any education to the child,
oh.
However intelligent they are,
mm-hmm.
because it gives a kind of a pressure to the child.
True.
It's a kind of bottled up pressure.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like it. Even if they have very high IQs,
mm-hmm.
and you see them knowing everything, you know, you feel encouraged to make them read and
yeah,
to make them
you
know
just
so
put
much.
More and more pressure.
Yeah. But if it's through playing, it's a different thing altogether.
Okay.
Because they need to be free. Completely,
yeah,
in
true.
Playing whatever they wish to.
Mm-hmm.
So the moment you feel that it's like now it's getting like a pressure for them,
mm-hmm.
even if they're reading and you're teaching them whilst playing,
mm-hmm.
you feel it's now pressurizing them, let's just leave it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's better to leave it and to continue later on when they're renewed and they feel like.
Okay.
There's some children who feel like and they keep on saying. So educational importance is part of it, the playing, and the moral importance. That's very important.
Mm-hmm.
The moral importance is not touched by the others, the you know, like...
the Western theories.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
The other ideologies,
ideology.
If you go and see. In the period of playing, a child learns what is good, what is bad. The child finds out that if he desires to be counted as an acceptable person in an activity, he must be truthful.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
And he must be trustworthy.
Mm.
And he must be fair. He must be disciplined.
Mm.
He must be truth-seeking.
And this all comes in with Islam.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So all together, all in all, child and play are very important and go hand in hand,
mm.
especially for the first seven years. And that's why we you know, talked about this whole theories and how to go about you know, coming and towards Islam, that Islam encourages so much why a child to play.
Alright, thank you very much, Sister Salma Khalfan. And thank you, dear listeners, for joining us on these programs. Inshallah, till the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life. A way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Inshallah.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back to the European News Bulletin with me, Robert Carter. Later on, we'll be discussing the major headlines, and in our social media section, you'll get your chance to have your views discussed by me and our social media correspondent. But first, let's take a look at tonight's top story. The state crackdown on Muslims in France continues to escalate after the president, Emmanuel Macron, demanded that French Muslim leaders adopt republican values. Macron issued a 15-day ultimatum for the French Council of the Muslim Faith to draw up a new charter that must also stipulate Islam is a religion and not a political movement. The move coincides with the announcement that France will close the country's biggest anti-Islamophobia organization, the Collective Against Islamophobia in France. As criticism of European leaders and their authoritarian actions against Muslims continues to grow, questions about the concept of freedom of speech are once again being raised. So, I decided to take a crack at trying to test the limits of freedom to insult and whether it was a right which should be allowed in all cases. Regarding people's freedom of speech has flared up once again in Europe, pitting those who hate Islam versus Muslims who want to defend their beliefs from ridicule. But is a person's ability to insult those beloved by others a right to be protected, or is it just an unacceptable form of hate speech? Hate is on the rise across Europe. Right-wing sentiment has become a powerful political force, and Muslims are one of the biggest targets. For anyone who wants to make it their business to upset Muslims, then the best way is to attack and insult Islam's holiest symbols. In France, for example, a well-known racist magazine, Charlie Hebdo, has enjoyed mocking religions for many years. But its obsession with Islam raises the most concern. With insulting caricatures of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad depicted on its front cover again and again. For many Muslims, it is seen as deeply disrespectful to depict the prophet in any form. Yet despite global outrage and an outbreak of violence, the magazine continues to insult with blessings from the state.
And I will always defend freedom of speech in my country and freedom of thought, of drawing.
So France defends people's rights to deeply insult 1.8 billion Muslims worldwide, yet the simple rebellious act of burning a French flag is totally outlawed. Elsewhere, radical Islamophobes have taken things a step further. In the Scandinavian countries of Sweden, Denmark and Norway, Quran-burning rallies have not only occurred, but have been defended as well. With the Norwegian Prime Minister defending a racist thug's rights to desecrate this holy book. That's right, Norway defends book desecration. You know, the practice synonymous with fascism and brainwashing. Okay, so some of you may say that I'm not a Muslim, I don't get offended by these acts, freedom of speech must be protected for all. Well, then why is it that freedom of speech is not guaranteed to Muslims equally? Across Europe, many anti-Muslim measures have been enforced, including a ban on Muslim burqas, a way which Muslim women express their love for God. The ban on mosques being built in countries such as Slovakia or Italy, an ideal place for Muslims to speak and share ideas. And what about all the new anti-political Islam laws being introduced in France and Austria, which seeks to conflate outspoken political Muslims with radicalism and terrorism?
Im Kampf gegen den politischen Islam,
in the fight against political Islam, the ideological basis behind it, we are going to create a criminal offense called political Islam in order to be able to move against those who aren't terrorists but are preparing the ground for it.
Does that mean I'm a terrorist just because I'm a journalist who identifies as being a Muslim? Is that what they call freedom of speech? Now, what if I told you that total freedom of speech doesn't actually exist anyway, and that it's a good thing? Take France, for example. It is illegal to deny the Holocaust, for obvious reasons. Also, if I was to write an article using the N-word to describe people from Africa, I could get detained in the UK for peddling racist hate speech, which makes sense. Insulting and spreading hate is rightly not tolerated, but when it comes to Muslims and Islam, hate speakers seem to have total freedom. This sounds much more like white privilege than freedom of speech to me. In other news, former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said that Jeremy Corbyn must make a full public apology over his recent comments on anti-Semitism before he can be readmitted as an opposition Labour Party MP. Mr. Brown insisted that Corbyn must make it clear that he has no tolerance for racism against Jewish people. Corbyn's suspension came after he stated the scale of the problem of Labour's anti-Semitism was dramatically overstated for political reasons by our opponents. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said on Thursday he was ending the era of cutting defence spending, adding that he will be injecting £16.5 billion cash into the defence budget. The British Prime Minister announced that the huge cash injection would pave the way for upgrades in military capabilities, including plans for laser guns and an artificial intelligence agency. The military spending comes amid an economic crisis due to the COVID pandemic and government resistance to fund free school meals for children during holidays. A top Downing Street ministerial advisor has resigned following an announcement by Prime Minister Boris Johnson that he's backing Home Secretary Priti Patel, despite allegations of bullying. An investigation into right-winger Patel's conduct found that she had failed to meet the ministerial requirements for treating civil servants with respect and consideration. A government statement said Mr. Johnson has full confidence in Ms. Patel and considers this matter now closed. Well, we've now reached that special time in the programme where we assess the online reaction to some of the major stories. And joining me first for this is correspondent and colleague Richard Sudan. Richard, thank you very much for joining me. Now, let's go straight to your first story. What have you got for me?
Absolutely. So more on this, frankly, latest controversy to engulf Westminster. Of course, Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, was actually found in an internal Cabinet Office inquiry to basically be regularly swearing and shouting at staff. And it seems unconscionable in many ways that the Prime Minister in some ways would back Priti Patel, but then again a lot of people would say the Prime Minister lacks any kind of moral conviction himself. As you just alluded to, Sir Alex Allen, who is actually the Prime Minister's ministerial code advisor, has actually quit in a symbolic gesture given the Prime Minister's backing of Priti Patel. But of course, regarding Priti Patel herself, perhaps this really shouldn't come as any surprise to people, because she's characterised as introducing some of the most hardline policies regarding immigration. Under her own policies, for example, her own parents wouldn't have been able to enter the country in the 1960s. Of course, Priti Patel also had to resign from Theresa May's government after she had secret meetings with Israel. So this gives you some idea of the character of Priti Patel. And of course, you know, a lot of people would say that Boris Johnson's premiership is predicated on kind of hardline British nationalism, which many people would say Priti Patel is certainly an advocate of. And
so it sounds like she's a pretty grim character, the way you're describing it. That's obviously your point of view, but I'd like to see what people are saying online to see if they share your views of Priti Patel.
Absolutely. There's not many people tweeting in support of her, Robert, I'll tell you that. Let's go first to Sebastian G, who says, Priti Patel, the sort of person who would unplug your life support machine to charge her mobile phone. A pretty strong condemnation there of the Home Secretary. And Mem says, I know several people who have told me how shocked they are at Trump's behaviour, yet have voted for this UK government, which are employing similar tactics after her Israel trip. How is Priti Patel even in the government to bully staff? Interesting question.
Richard, before we run out of time on this story, I want to ask you, for people outside of the UK who may not know very well, you know, she's obviously a woman in government, and she's used it as an example of how the Tory party is not racist and is inclusive. But obviously her reputation doesn't actually polish that image. Perhaps you could briefly explain.
Again, I want to reiterate this point. Priti Patel has made life, many would say, unbearable for many of our immigrant communities from across the spectrum. She's introduced policies which have made it increasingly difficult for people to enter the country. And of course, many people would say she certainly contributed to the quote-unquote hostile environment, which unfortunately Britain has become characterised by in recent years. Of course, not just under Boris Johnson.
I'm going to jump in, Richard, because we are out of time and I want to move on to this next story. Some huge embarrassment caused in the US now regarding Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. Tell me more.
Absolutely. So former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani turned attorney for Trump seems to have had a kind of figurative meltdown, but also a literal one in a video of a press conference, which everyone's talking about. Before we get into this, let's just roll a brief clip of the press conference itself.
And what I'm talking about is the absentee ballots for which there were no applications. And that's not just a small matter. The reason for the application and the reason to keep all these things together is precisely to avoid what the Democrats did in this election, which is to misuse the absentee ballot process and the mail-in ballot process in order to cheat.
He's laughing at the Democrats there, but everyone seems to be laughing at him and his bizarre hair malfunction.
Absolutely, everyone's laughing. And of course, you know, Giuliani's really sticking his political neck out for Donald Trump. But we've seen Donald Trump fire several of his advisors recently, and of course over the years. And so Rudy Giuliani may well find himself thrown under the wayside. We've seen incredible accusations, including claims that apparently Venezuela and also Cuba have undermined the election, although Jimmy Carter, former president, has actually said Venezuela has some of the freest and fairest elections in the world. And I would say there's kind of an academic quality, many people think, regarding the US sort of singing about the democratic process. Much of the world would actually say that whoever is in power, be it red or blue, be it Republican or Democrat, the United States, historically and in the modern context, has done, you know, many, many things to undermine real democratic processes and movements all across the world. So, I mean, this is the latest embarrassment for Washington, but I suspect, Robert, we're going to see a few more in the coming weeks.
For sure, it's the latest in a long line of embarrassments, I dare say, for the White House right now. But let's go to social media, because I'm sure, you know, this funny video hasn't gone unnoticed online.
Absolutely, nearly broke the internet. Let's go first to Goody Howe, who says, Trump is a national disgrace. Trump's claims about voter fraud are as real as the colour of Giuliani's hair. And Stu Cameron says, Rudy Giuliani is still unsuccessfully trying to change the colour of the election map when he can't successfully change the colour of his own hair. And I wish I could say these tweets were the exception to the rule, but I've seen loads of them, Robert.
Fake tans, fake hair, fake elections. What is real in the US? That's the big question I have now. Thank you very much, Richard Sudan, for speaking to us there. Well, moving on now, the World Health Organization has declared that the new round of lockdowns implemented in many European countries could have been avoided and should have only been imposed as a last resort. The WHO regional director for Europe, Dr. Hans Kluger, has advised that mask wearing, social distancing and self-isolation, if done properly, would be enough to prevent economically suffocating lockdowns. Dr. Kluger added that despite encouraging news about vaccines, they should not be viewed as a silver bullet, as supplies will be limited, particularly in the beginning. In the US, the Trump campaign has alleged more voter fraud as former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani announced more litigation that aims to secure his candidate a second term in the White House. Murtaza Jaffa brings us the latest.
The election process in the United States is under further scrutiny after Rudy Giuliani, the personal attorney of US President Donald Trump, held a press conference to reiterate claims of voter fraud by Democratic candidate Joe Biden.
The company counting our vote with control over our vote is owned by two Venezuelans who were allies of Chavez, are present allies of Maduro, with a company whose chairman is a close associate and business partner of George Soros, the biggest donor to the Democrat Party, the biggest donor to Antifa, and the biggest donor to Black Lives Matter. My goodness, what do we have to do to get you to give our people the truth?
The former New York City mayor was widely mocked in the mainstream media after he appeared to sweat off some of his hair dye in images that made front pages around the world. Pro-Biden commentators joked that the Trump team were literally melting away. Senior Republicans have also begun to call for an end to Trump's refusal to concede the election. Former Republican candidate Senator Mitt Romney took to Twitter and condemned Trump's team. He said it was difficult to imagine a worse, more undemocratic action by a sitting American president. Meanwhile, President-elect Joe Biden held a press conference after a meeting with a number of governors and criticized the Trump campaign.
I think they're witnessing incredible irresponsibility, incredibly damaging messages being sent to the rest of the world about how democracy functions. And I think it is, I don't know his motive, but I just think it's totally irresponsible.
Trump is facing a number of federal charges, with allegations of tax fraud in a number of states. Some believe a pledge of pardon from the incoming president will persuade him to move on. But for now, Trump is standing firm, backed by his huge electoral base, and for the moment, the majority of Republican senators.
Well, we're heading back over to social media, only this time I'm joined in the studio by my other colleague, Robert Inlakesh. Thank you very much, Rob, for joining me. Now, let's head over to your stories. Your first one takes us to occupied Palestine, where Pompeo has visited some illegal Israeli settlements, I believe.
Yes, in both the Golan Heights, which is illegally occupied by Israel and belongs rightfully to Syria, according to international law, and the occupied West Bank, which belongs to the Palestinian people, according to international law. But, however, we know since 2019, the Trump administration has considered these two territories to be part of Israel officially. Essentially recognizing an annexation of the land, which of course would be in contrary to international law. And his visit, his recent visit, was the first of its kind by a U.S. official to an Israeli or Golan Heights settlement. And of course, when he went there, he endorsed, not only did he go there and endorse the settlement, say that they were legitimate, but then he went on to say that Israeli settler goods should be labeled as products from Israel proper, again, against international law, promoted them, and then went on to slam BDS as a cancer, as he describes it, calling it anti-Semitic, and therefore labeling the likes of Black Lives Matter and many other groups in the United States, progressive groups in the United States, as being anti-Semitic when their whole thing is fighting racism. On top of that as well, he's been implicated in the expansion of settlements and the endorsing expansion of settlements in East Jerusalem al-Quds, the Givat Hamatos, Ramat Shlomo, and the Atarot settlements, which would basically form a ring around East Jerusalem al-Quds, making it absolutely impossible for there to be a viable capital for a future state, a Palestinian state, if, of course, that was what the Israelis were actually looking for.
Looks like he's on the verge of ending his time in the White House on a political low, attacking both the BDS movement, which is a peaceful pro-Palestine movement, and Palestine itself, Rob. Let's go to social media and see what people are saying online. What's the reaction been?
Well, the first one we have here from Joe Catron, who points out that Amnesty International said the State Department's attack on the BDS movement violates freedom of expression and endangers human rights protection. We've got another one here commenting on this issue as well. They say, you are inverting reality. Like its predecessor, South Africa, BDS is inherently an anti-racist movement designed to free people from racist oppression. Denying them that right makes the U.S. regime a racist regime. Not only that, you will foment foment anti-Semitism by doing this. And a lot of people have brought up that, in fact, equating Zionism and all Jews is something in of itself extremely anti-Semitic.
And that's something which the U.S. Foreign Office actually did on its Twitter page, I believe. It did actually make very clear a statement that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, but we all know that many Zionists are not actually Jews at all, and many Jews are anti-Zionist.
Absolutely, and not only that, but back in the 1970s, in 1975, I believe, the United Nations actually adopted Zionism as a form of racism. That was later reversed in 1991. But this has been, you know, in the popular discourse for some time, that Zionism as an idea, as a European settler colonial idea, is tantamount to racism. And so when they're saying that Zionism is akin to all Jewish people, you're trying to basically paint a broad brush over Jews and say that they're all racists, which is outrageous.
It is outrageous. Of course, that's not true either, so we stand by that statement. Let's move on to your final story of the evening. It takes us to Saudi Arabia now. Seems as if they're pro-nuclear armament. Tell me more.
Absolutely. So we have the statement coming out of Saudi Arabia, sort of threatening Iran, saying that they will look at an option of attempting to arm themselves with a nuclear weapon. I mean, really, Mohammed bin Salman must be trying to pursue a career in stand-up comedy, because this is just absolutely hilarious. If you look at it, the likelihood of them being able to attain a nuclear weapon is so slight. I mean, the United Arab Emirates, which is much better, much smarter, strategic than Saudi Arabia is, a lot more capable, just had an arms deal worth over $100 billion with the United States, which would have benefited the United States, blocked in the Senate. And that was just for things like F-35s, etc., other military equipment, which, you know, a lot of senators senators felt shouldn't go to the UAE. Saudi Arabia is a lot more radical. Saudi Arabia, of course, can't even fight off Ansarullah inside of Yemen, and is open to attacks like we saw the very successful, well-organized attack, which was extremely well done, against the Aramco facilities just last year. I mean, Saudi Arabia trying to threaten Iran at this point is just comical.
Well, the one thing that I will say on this, obviously you have your views, Rob, is that the fact that Saudi Arabia is talking as if a nuclear armament is a thing that they're happy to pursue, when the leader of the Islamic Revolution has always made clear that Iran has no interest in building a nuclear weapon because they just don't believe in it. It's not moral. It's not acceptable. This is something which I've always respected, Ayatollah Khamenei for.
Absolutely. And on top of that, if we look at this, I mean, the United States are talking, obviously, they justify their sanctions. They attempt to justify their sanctions against Iran by saying, look, they want to, look, they're radical Islamists, as they say, and they want to acquire a nuclear weapon. But then you have Saudi Arabia, which, you know, has had links to funding Al-Qaeda-linked groups inside of Syria. And they're openly talking about arming themselves with a nuclear weapon, but no sanctions there for Saudi Arabia, no cancelling of weapons deals for them.
You've raised some very interesting points. I will take us straight to social media, though, before we run out of time, and perhaps you could tell me what people are saying online about this.
The first comment we've got here says, what is Trump up to in his final weeks in office? He wants to reduce the size of our forces in Afghanistan and Iraq while provoking tensions in Iran, creating a destabilizing effect in the greater Middle Eastern region. And then we have another one here by Twitter account Station Shippen, who says, the Saudis couldn't pull a military victory off against a small Bedouin tribe equipped with camels and swords. I hope it truly believes it can beat Iran. We get to see the end of the Saudi regime if they try anything. Grab the popcorn. So a very, of course, passionate response there.
Thank you very much, Robin Mukesh. We are unfortunately out of time, so we'll have to leave it there. But thank you for joining me. And thank you to everyone else for joining us on this edition of the program. Thank you very much for now. It's goodbye from us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Despite being one of the world's biggest contributors to plastic pollution, the United States of America has so far shown no signs of joining an international treaty aimed at stopping plastics from flowing into the world's oceans and other natural habitats, leaving the country in a small minority, as more than two-thirds of United Nations member states signal that a treaty is forthcoming. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Julia Conley, writer. This article is published under the heading, More Than Two-Thirds of UN Members Embrace Global Plastic Pollution Treaty, but Not the United States. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Despite being one of the world's biggest contributors to plastic pollution, the U.S. has so far shown no signs of joining an international treaty aimed at stopping plastics from flowing into the world's oceans and other natural habitats, leaving the country in a small minority, as more than two-thirds of United Nations member states signal that a treaty is forthcoming. At a virtual conference attended last week by the UN's Working Group on Ocean Pollution and Microplastics, countries in Africa, the Pacific, the Baltic region, and throughout Europe confirmed that they are open to signing a treaty aimed at sharply reducing marine plastic pollution and potentially all plastic waste. Yet again, with an environmental agreement, this one on plastic pollution, it is the U.S. that is the holdout. The United States of America was joined by the United Kingdom in declining to participate in the treaty, although the two countries are the biggest per capita plastic polluters in the world. British Environmental Minister Zach Goldsmith is expected to announce soon whether the country is open to a new treaty or to strengthening the existing international framework governing plastic pollution, while the Trump administration has indicated it is not open to a global treaty on plastics. Support for a global treaty on plastic pollution is a critical action that the new U.S. administration can take to correct the wrongs of the Trump era. Tim Gabriel, senior lawyer at the Environmental Investigations Agency, or EIA, told The Guardian on Monday, November 16th. Over the last 4 years, we have continually encountered opposition from the Trump administration to truly address plastic pollution, slowing down progress and watering down international efforts. We are hopeful that with a change in leadership at the top, the U.S. will join its allies and support a global treaty on plastic pollution at the UN Environmental Assembly's fifth conference. EIA has called for a legally binding global agreement including four pillars to combat plastic pollution from all sources. The group says any treaty ultimately agreed upon by UN countries must include
monitoring and reporting on the state of plastic pollution, and each nation's progress toward a circular economy in which plastic leakage into the environment is kept to a minimum. Prevention of plastic waste through bans on single-use plastic products and restrictions on plastic production. Coordination between existing anti-plastic pollution frameworks, including the 2001 Stockholm Convention, under which countries agreed to limit or ban the use of certain toxic chemicals, including some used in plastics, and the 1989 Basel Convention, which aimed to reduce hazardous waste production, and the transboundary movement of such waste. Also, technical and financial support for developing countries from wealthier countries. The UN Environmental Assembly concluded in 2017 that the Stockholm and Basel Conventions are fragmented and ineffective as they are currently implemented, according to The Guardian. The US is only a party to the Basel Convention. The Assembly is currently expected to meet in Kenya in February 2021 for its fifth conference, or in 2022 if the summit is postponed due to the coronavirus pandemic. Even without the participation of the United States of America and United Kingdom, the EIA called the commitment of a majority of UN countries to a new treaty heartening. Maintaining the status quo is not only untenable, it would have catastrophic implications for planet Earth, Christina Dixon, senior ocean campaigner at EIA, told The Guardian. Global plastic pollution efforts implemented so far are expected to reduce plastic pollution by just 7%, while the oceans are expected to be inundated with 29 million metric tons per year by 2040, triple the amount that currently flows into marine habitats annually. As the UN Working Group was meeting last week, the World Wildlife Federation, WWF, circulated a petition signed by 2 million people so far, calling for a global anti-plastic pollution treaty. More than 11 million metric tons of plastic is flowing into the ocean each year. We are drowning in plastic, but we can resurface. World leaders urgently need to vote for a UN treaty to tackle this crisis. Now is the time to call for a plastic pollution treaty. We are drowning in plastic, but we can resurface it. The WWF tweeted, "World leaders urgently need to vote for a UN treaty to tackle this crisis."
Yemen, a tortured land with its people ravaged in all imaginable ways. Already a poor country, Yemen goes through hell every day. Poverty has been exacerbated by drought, famine, disease, embargo, and war. The Saudi-led campaign has opened a Pandora's box for the Yemeni people, including children. There are numerous reports that Yemeni kids as young as 7 are being recruited by the Saudi-led campaign to kill or be killed while fighting against their will and against their homeland. A little child in red identifies himself on a hill, facing his enemy on the other hill. Blood, bombs, bullets, and bodies. These are drawings by former child soldiers recruited by the Saudi-led coalition, which show what's going on inside their minds. It clearly shows they have been robbed of their childhoods, but they're not alone. In 2019, UNICEF reported that there are more than 2,700 cases of children enlisted in combat in Yemen, pointing out that this could be the tip of the iceberg. Exclusive footage from Al Jazeera shows that these children are being recruited to ironically defend the Saudi border, as if billions of dollars worth of purchased arms and military equipment are not enough for that purpose. One of these child soldiers is Ahmad Al-Naghib, from a village near Taiz, who left home when he was 15 years old. He'd been promised to get regular paychecks and a job in the kitchens of Yemeni military units on Saudi soil. We went because we were told we would be working in a kitchen and making 3,000 Saudi riyals, $800. So we believed them and got on the bus.
They know about the people that they are recruiting, the people they are promising what seems to be large amounts of money, not delivering those large amounts of money, sometimes tricking them into being, thinking they're going to be workers, kitchen hands, or in some cases, and then being pushed into the front line with weapons. So I'm sure that they know about it, and I think it does reflect the fact that the Saudis have very little respect for people in their own system at the bottom of the heap, so to speak.
Investigative groups have identified a military camp in Al Bura, near the Saudi border, where the child recruits are being trained. The recruitment process is facilitated by human traffickers, and the recruits are given identification cards before crossing into Saudi Arabia and being placed into a military camp.
It's considered a war crime generally, because children, that is to say those under 18, are not considered capable of giving an informed consent to take on the responsibility of joining a military and being under orders to carry out what might be serious criminal activity. Remember that soldiers, since the Second World War, are regarded to have their own capacity to reject orders which require them to carry out crime. So there is a type of adult conscience and a capacity to, on the one hand, take on responsibility, on the other hand, to disobey orders, which are criminal orders. And so children are not capable of that. They're taken advantage of. And the trickery I mentioned before is something that also children are very susceptible to. So there's less chance of children rejecting those sorts of orders or standing up against resisting what they're being asked to do. So that's why there's this general consensus around the world that children should not be recruited into, particularly going into situations where they are engaged in conflicts that they don't understand.
According to Geneva-based human rights monitoring organization SAM, many Yemenis are entering the kingdom under the pretext of receiving emergency treatment, only to be sent to the Yemeni-Saudi border to fight for Riyadh. The Saudi-led coalition is recruiting boys from schools, poor urban areas, and detention centers, inducing them to fight with a combination of bribes, indoctrination, and coercion, according to the Times.
I think it's really taking advantage of poor families, both Yemeni families in the border areas, and also poor families in the surrounding regions, including from Sudan, taking advantage of recruiting these young people, promising them, tricking them in some cases into sending their young people in to act as very ineffective soldiers in this terrible war. And it's also reflects, I think, a part of the Saudi culture of disrespect for these young people. They don't really care if they live or die.
But the Saudi-led coalition does not recruit only Yemeni children. In late 2018, Riyadh came under fire for recruiting Sudanese children to fight on its behalf in Yemen. Tens of thousands of desperate survivors of the conflict in Darfur, many of them children, are now fighting in Yemen. Most of them belong to the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, a tribal militia previously known as the Janjaweed. These children are reportedly being paid in Saudi riyals, the equivalent of about $480 a month for a 14-year-old novice. They receive an additional $185 to $285 for any month they saw combat. Their payments were deposited directly into the Faisal Islamic Bank of Sudan, partly owned by Saudis. According to the Times, Sudanese soldiers who fought in Yemen said that between 20% and 40% of their units were made up of children.
I think we need to understand what the Saudis represent in the region. That's very important, that the Saudis are there as an arm of the old colonial regime, of the British regime initially and now run by the North Americans, that they are a proxy for effectively a barrier between the British and the Americans being held accountable for their responsibilities for the terrible dirty war and the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen, that really these young people that are being recruited by the Saudis are effectively masking the responsibility of the NATO powers that are sending so many arms and weapons to perpetuate this sort of war. And I don't think we can understand that unless we understand the role of the Saudis and the fact that they are only there to carry out the orders of these big powers from outside trying to manipulate events within the region. So I think that the role of Al-Saud, generally the family, needs to be understood to understand why there are so many appalling acts going on, including the use of child soldiers to perpetuate this dirty war against Yemen.
A dirty game has been at play since the Saudi-led invasion of Yemen. With billions of dollars in their pockets, the Saudi-led gang is still trying to outsource the war. They want to keep the cost of the war at the lowest possible level. So they're using child mercenaries from poor backgrounds in Yemen or Sudan. Those whose lives are cheaper than the ones in Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Bahrain.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies.
shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.